Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
You're on, Lynn.
I love it. That was the voice of our founder and the original gang of two, then expanded to five or six. I think that was Brian Brown, our founder, and it's lovely to hear his lilt. Love that voice. Thanks, Truman. And this is Lynn Kerrigan. I'm going to be hosting today, formerly known as shortstop and first baseman of the Midway debutantes in Decatur, Georgia. I'm calling the record straight for now. And joined in the studio here by our autopilot, Truman O'Brien. And Truman, I have to tell you how often I want to say Truman Capote.
Oh, trust me, it wouldn't be the first time I've heard it. You can imagine.
Well, I want you to stay in your Truman O'Brien persona while you're on the air.
Thank you. I'll try to do that.
Yeah. And so let me know if anybody is thinking of anything in particular or that you want us to spin back by to or found anything amusing or funny that we should get out on the air as we get started today. Truman, anything in rattling around in your brain?
No, but I'm missing our Guardian of the Galaxy. I don't see
that's
him.
That's right. He was not able to be here today. He told me anyway that he was going to be doing some personal business in Olympia, and so he couldn't be here.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I missed that.
So I'm going, and don't worry about him. He'll listen in if he can.
Well, I was sweating in here thinking I'd done something wrong.
Wisdom. Thanks, Truman. Also with me is, I'm going to name first Kevin Jones, who is our indivisible, invincible, incredible. I think of you as one of those wee machines, Kevin, just so many eyes in your team name. I don't know what to do. Invincible, incredible, indivisible, Kevin Jones. Kevin, what's up for you?
Happy to be here. I keep thinking back to the Pledge of Allegiance when when I think of indivisible with liberty and justice for all. We're busy, you know, we're managing to try to keep up with the election results that came in from the primary and to see those candidates who will need our help in Washington State and looking across the country at some of the challenges for voting and the post office, of course, is one of those primary issues right at the moment. So, there's plenty of opportunity to stay engaged.
We'll be coming back to that little agenda in just a minute, but I want to also say welcome to Chet, also known as Michael Shook, also known as Chauncey Gardner. He's very fond of his aliases. He's now also Shed Man. One-handedly putting up an entirely new building out front, and I don't know how you do it. I don't know how you carry all those beams, but it's looking good. How are you?
I'm doing swell, thank you. Well, carpenter. That's that's all you need to know.
So
carpenters, we figure things out.
So what was the critter that you signed on with today? I missed that. Was it a beaver or what is it?
It's a little porcupine.
Oh, it's a porcupine. Oh.
Nice.
Yeah, which is actually called a porcupine.
Oh, well, isn't that? That's clever.
Yeah, the baby porcupine. Oh, you little bastard. Yes.
Is that Chet?
Did you just say
one of the nine words that you can't say on the air?
He said, very endearing. So happy. Look, I clap. Our listener can't see that, but
it's a shame. We are joined by another member today. This It looks like an old jacket I had in the 70s. If I wadded that up and put it on my hand, it would look just like it. And from there, I'll move to our female guardian in the galaxy, Wonder Woman, and Incredible. What's her name? The Woman Incredible. I like her. She has the voice of Holly Hunter, which I pay attention to because she, too, is from Atlanta.
He has an accent similar to yours, actually.
He does, because she's from Atlanta. Mm-hmm. I know. But Susan McKay, what's going on today with your radio show, Real Talk, and anything else?
I'm doing an encore show with photographer David Lynch, who went to our southern border and lived with immigrants and asylum seekers there in 2019. Photographed them and created a book called At the Border. And unfortunately, all of that is still relevant.
Wow. Wow. Thank you. Susan is a real journalist here, actually getting to interview people. It's our own Terry Gross, and I'm so glad you're able to do that for us. Thank you. And what we're going to do is we're gonna roam around through a bunch of things today. I mean, there's the sacred and the profane, you know, there's certainly plenty of the profane between the corruption in the U.S. Postal Service, which we'll come back to, and, you know, a lot of the losses of jobs and repercussions happening now with the, you know, local losses of leadership, jobs, you know, police, and, you know, city government. It's really interesting, the passage or the anointment of Kamala Harris as the presumptive vice presidential candidate. We have that to think about. And the fact that this is the anniversary, the 100th anniversary today, thanks to Michael Shook, alert team member who sent the date that today, the August 18th, 1920, is the anniversary of the date that the Tennessee legislature ratified the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote. So we were the last in getting right to vote. And, you know, I've been thinking a lot about that because there are some pretty fabulous women holding the fort right now. And Truman, I've been thinking about some of them that paved the way.
In the shower and the blood starts pumping. Out on the streets the traffic starts jumping. With folks like me on the job from 9 to 5. Working 9 to 5. What a way to make a living. Barely getting by. It's all taking and no giving. They just use your mind and they never give you credit. It's enough to drive you crazy if you let it. 9 to 5 for service.
Thank you, Truman. We're having fun now thinking about being on the vice presidential ticket, and what a great shout out to African-American women. I was pretty happy about that. Wanted to talk with y'all about what you thought about Kamala Harris and kind of what she brings to the party.
Okay, I'll go.
Go, please.
I am delighted that that Biden chose her as his running mate. I think she brings incredible competence to the position. If she should become president at some point, I think we'd be in very good hands. And I'd like to also mention that while this is the 100th anniversary of the passage of the Voting Rights Amendment for women, there are a lot of Black people in suffrage who were ignored and even didn't really get the vote at that time. So I'm hearing a lot of folks are covering that part of the suffrage movement today, and I'm happy to see it.
Thank you. And I will piggyback on that for 1 second to say I am still awaiting the ratification of the Equal Rights Amendment.
Yes.
Not to be confused with the voting suffrage amendment, which we're talking about, that happened in 1920, hard as it was to get to everybody. It still hasn't for sure. But then we're still waiting what could happen if the extension date happened. And I just think of Nancy Pelosi and, you know, some of the incredible women, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, people that are, that happen to be women, that are populating our leadership positions and doing such a great job. What did y'all think of Kamala Harris and anything else happening in that political line, Kevin?
Yeah, you know, I'm kind of intrigued this whole notion of cognitive dissonance that she throws into the current administration's rhetoric machine. They can't figure out if she's a tough on crime prosecutor that the lefties can't tolerate, or she's a radical socialist who's going to basically, you know, throw all the children under the bus. That she, I don't know. It just goes on and on from there. You know, they're just searching for this. But, you know, I think that the reality is, as you mentioned, Lynn, there's, you know, tremendously competent and qualified people. And gender is not a barrier to that qualification, certainly at this point in time. And after the 2016 election, shortly after, where groups like Indivisible came together. And if you're not a part of an Indivisible group, you don't know that there's probably at least 75% to 80% women who are part of that movement. And the idea that women have fought so long, not only as today's recognition of voting rights, but also just rights to equal pay, which isn't there yet, and rights to control your own reproductive rights and schedules, and all of those things are now at jeopardy. And the idea that women were going to would be such a key factor in this decision that faces us in November about the leadership that's appropriate for the country, and I'm just very honored, I guess, to see those voices enabled, and hopefully we'll be able to collectively change the course of the leadership in the country.
Well, well thought out. What about y'all, Truman and Michael?
I was likewise thrilled at the choice. I think, as we've all talked about, there were a number of really highly qualified people, but she strikes me as someone who's, you know, who's battle tested, who's been Attorney General of California, the fifth largest economy if it were to break away,
something like that.
In the world, and it's a hugely important and job, governing at that level, being part of that state's government, and then her work in the Senate and being out on the campaign trail. I just am really impressed with her. Well, with just, she's a fantastic candidate. She's everything you want, intelligent, savvy, knows how to do politics, knows politics is about power. And sometimes we get that confused, I think. We think, oh, politics is about justice or about equality or something. And it's like, no, politics is about power. And then what you do with that power comes afterwards. And she gets that, I think.
So I have a question for both you and Truman. And Truman, I'm not forgetting you there, okay. But this, you can fold this into your answer. The thing that I think a lot about is it's a pretty bold ticket. You know, we've clearly got Joe, the moderate centrist, you know, out there to try to match, you know, the old white guy syndrome that's apparently needed in much of America to not be ridiculed to death. And rather than sort of cave fully on the Obama slamming that happened for 8 years, you know, I thought it was quite the 1-2 punch to come in with both Biden and now with Kamala Harris. So I guess I'm asking you both, you know, do you think that's too weird a pairing, you know, to try to be both progressive and feisty and, you know, older and more measured? Do you think the setup for 2024, you know, which is they're stating very baldly as possible, you know, if this is a transition presidency for, you know, for Biden, what do y'all think?
Michael?
Well, I don't think there's any, I don't think there's any problem at all with that. I think, you know, people have picked, you know, Lincoln picked Jackson.
Johnson,
thank you. Yeah, Andrew Johnson, is it because he knew he had to appeal to some other people or he wasn't ever going to be able to get any legislation taken care of that he needed? And it, of course, it turned out to be a disaster after he was assassinated, but he couldn't foresee that. But no, I think it's a great pairing. I think it's fabulous. She's so dynamic, you know. And
what do you think, Jermaine?
Well,
and her kid's nickname for her is Mamala.
Mamala. That's a great name.
Which also happens to be Yiddish for little mama, which is a term of endearment there, which I love that. She's, her husband happens to be Jewish. Her stepkids are Jewish, big deal. But, you know, but I love Mamala Kamala, go.
I tried to get my grandkids to call me Yoda, but they wanted none of that.
Well, you're wise enough to be Yoda. I mean, come on. What do you want?
That's what I told them.
Yeah.
They mostly kidded me about my ears, which can be very pointed as well as my tongue. So between the three of them, that was all they had to say.
I think Kamala might be little mama because we just discovered she's only 5'2".
Yeah. Oh, well, she doesn't act like it, does she?
No. Well, she has a tall personality.
That's right.
Exactly.
Well, my first choice was Amy Klobuchar. And then when she bowed out, I thought, well, Susan Rice, you know, would be great because of the diplomatic background that she had. And I was a little bit leery of Kamala Harris because I thought she might be too much of a lightning rod and too much of a distraction and might turn people off because of that. I was not for Stacey Abrams because, again, lack of experience and too much of a lightning rod again. But then I got to thinking about her, Kamala Harris, debating Pence. And I just started laughing, you know. I said, oh my gosh, this has got to be the show to watch. I mean, he's going to be like a deer in the headlights when he tangles with her. So I'm looking forward to that part of it.
Kevin?
Likewise, you know, Pence's, I don't know what they did to his spine, but it's like he's just immobile, it seems. And I'm waiting for the facial expressions, just like you said. You know, the other thing that is striking, I did watch the convention last night, you know, the day one. And, you know, it's a montage of cultures and genders and lifestyles that are being really presented to us as the face of our country, right, of America. And, you know, we have mentioned that Kamala is female, African-American, also Asian-American. The notion that there are so many groups that are underrepresented and, you know, in Washington state, you know, we've talked about the fact that there are a number of Asian American women running for state office, and maybe they will help finally take steps to put in the regulations and statutes we need to address some of the police violence that we see, because clearly we've known about it for so long, but not taken the actions necessary. So I think that it's just amazing in one ticket, we're seeing not only the old white guy factor, which was also part of the Obama plan, but we're seeing that again. And I think that's a healthy step for us.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think having a white guy in there, it's easy to forget just how, until fairly recently, I mean, up into the 40s, America was still more than 80% European extraction or Caucasian white people, whatever you want to call it. And that's an overwhelming majority. And so now I think we're down to somewhere in the 60% range, maybe a little more.
Lower.
Lower than that. Okay. So, and that's, and of course, we know that by, if everything continues to hold, which there's no reason to, no evidence that it's not going to, of course, we'll be, white people will be a minority by 2050, I think. Is that right, Kevin?
You know, I'm not sure. Brown is the New White is the name of the, is the title of the book.
Well, Hispanics at this point are 12% of the national, no, 16% of the national population, 12% with blacks.
I guess so, all I was getting at is that this is, I'm going to go Bruce Hallman on us here and say, when we look at the context of the of these things and how challenging it is to make social change. I mean, humans, we want the same thing day in, day out. And it's very unnerving for a lot of people to see that change. But I'm hopeful that this is a major step towards more change for the good. I know that my kids and their friends, it's not that it isn't irrelevant. It's not that ethnic background isn't relevant. It is very much so, but it's just not a, it's not any kind of a barrier to regard someone's ability or the fact that that person can govern well or something. It's, that's another human being like me, looks a little different, big deal.
Yeah. I've been reading this fabulous book about 11 subcultures within America. It's called American Nations, plural, talking about how over time this country was settled by such different groups of people that we forget that until the politics hydra rears up its ugly snake head with, you know, so many different coalitions that we've got to try to pull together and promote. But, you know, having lived some time in the South and realizing Atlanta was right on the tip of the Appalachian hillside, you know, to the north, and the deep south to the south, you know, that whole slave owning plantation oriented deep south culture. But Atlanta was more of a commercial hub that was protected by that plateau arrangement. Anyway, surrounded by, you know, the new French city of New Orleans and surrounded by Midlands, you know, the Delaware, Maryland, the lowlands, you know, the tidal cultures of the Dutch commerce people in New York, that everybody is sort of just trying to stay focused on their values. And, you know, it's very hard to pull together everybody. I'm really interested in how this election's going to go. It kind of terrifies me a little bit.
So going back to the convention, did other people besides Kevin see watch any of it last night?
Yeah, I did. And
what did you think?
I thought it was, as Kevin said, a real intimate display of diversity and of all the folks in our nation. And the comments, particularly, not just from the speakers who were excellent, but from the individuals they brought to the fore who talked very personally. It was moving, I thought, and hopefully more people participated than would if it were a live convention.
Did you see it over your computer or over television?
TV,
or
TV.
On my computer. I got it free via CNN, no, MSNBC. Michelle Obama was dynamite.
I heard some clips of her.
She's, of course, getting the most attention, but it was, if it continues that way all week, I hope that the reports in media encourage more people to participate and to watch. Because I think it could be inspiring and, most important, get people out to vote.
Thank you.
Yeah, two things struck me. The first was an impression of slickness because of the production values And that bothered me a little bit. And then it went from slickness to hokey homey, you know, when they were talking to the store owner and the farmer, and it was like, okay, we're going to be slick or we're going to be homey, you know. And then it kept going, and finally I started saying, you know, you're seeing more opinions and more ideas and more whatever than you'll ever see in a regular convention. And so maybe this is the way it should go into the future, because it has so much more impact, because it's affecting so many more people. The impact of the convention itself.
Kind of like a televised town hall. They just did a lot of interviews with a lot of different people.
Yeah, kind of like. And it felt a lot more inclusive than the regular conventions, because there all you're seeing are the talking heads and the speakers and the rowdiness in the crowd. You don't get what's actually on people's minds. So I don't know. I was torn at first. Kevin.
You know, we know this convention, as well as the one to follow with the Republicans, is a 5-day long infomercial, basically, right?
Exactly.
For the candidate. They were talking about the fact that in a convention, you would have press coverage, and the typical training for the press is to go seek multiple opinions. And so while in this particular case, the opinions we're going to hear are varied but supportive, in a convention with press, you would find varied and supportive and maybe not supportive. So it's just kind of intriguing. And I expect we'll see the same thing, of course, on the Republican side.
Kevin, let me ask you a question, and maybe somebody else knows even more about that. I don't know. But in my experience, the convention was not only the nominations, but it was also the development and the adoption of the platforms. You know, very specific principles that they were going to try to achieve in their campaigning. And then, you know, if they were elected, have you heard much about, you know, that part of the process yet this time?
And others may comment. I know, Susan, you were nodding too. But, you know, we heard in Bernie's talk, when he talked last night, about the work being done to bring the people together who were on the debate stage, for example, and forge a platform based on that. You know, and Bernie flat out said, you know, it wouldn't be the platform I would bring, but I'm not the one that the people selected. And we need to realize that the only candidate who's going to listen to the platform desires that we have is the Democrat. Not Trump will clearly ignore everything we bring to the table. So it's an ongoing process. And I think, as Bruce mentioned, you know, democracies, healthy democracies, reinvent themselves all the time. And I suspect that's what, you know, Bernie was alluding to.
Well, let me segue from there to my question about the payroll tax floating, you know, idea that Trump had this last week, the idea that, you know, to do part of the COVID rescue and the bailout to people, you know. And I know he doesn't have authority to do anything beyond a temporary thing, but my question is about sort of, you know, the sort of bald electioneering with the post office and the whole idea of that kind of, you know, play that's all just about getting reelected. It's not even legal. You need to kind of throws out anything. And my hope would be that the Republican convention would address kind of things they will and won't do. Susan, what's up?
Well, yeah, clearly what Trump proposed as a COVID fix can't happen. The payroll tax is the money that goes into Social Security. Duh. So if we cancel that,
that's right.
Notion of gutting Social Security, along with any offer of weekly unemployment at $400 a week, he's only offering $300, and that's throwing more burden onto the state.
On the states, that's right.
His obfuscation, it's his throwing bones out there to people who don't really understand what he's saying. And it's, of course, dangerous.
Well, he may not understand what he's saying, Michael.
Yeah, I totally, Susan. That's, I mean, it's obviously was another blatant. He just throws stuff, red meat, out to his base. The only people that is going to resonate with is his base, and he's trying to keep them fired up. And the whole thing of canceling the payroll tax, it's not really being canceled. The employers would have to, and the employees would have to pay in again next year when the effect of it goes back.
And it balloons. Yeah, it's just a suspension,
yeah,
temporarily, till the end of the year, I believe, is all it
completely
can be.
Boneheaded maneuver. I mean, it's just only a blockhead could think that was something that was going to work.
Well, Kevin, I'll get to you in 1 second. It just reminds me of when he took over, not only the comment about, you know, I could shoot somebody on the street and they wouldn't stop me, but the other statement that he said about basically, you know, I can say and do anything. I'm, you know, above the law. I will react to everything because my job is to sow chaos like it's a reality TV show. He literally says that every day. I'm going to go out and do something outrageous. That's my job, to solve that little problem day by day, to create it and solve it. Kevin.
Yeah, this is, you know, the I weave this into the same thread or same mosaic as the Postal Service and the privatization of publicly held interests like Social Security, like Medicare, Medicaid, Postal Service. And, you know, the model is very clearly depicted for us in Russia, where they have the oligarchs who, when the Soviet Union was dismantled, certain people were selected to become tremendously rich. And they were the buddies of the communists in power. And that is a model that I believe is attractive to conservatives, those on the far right. And I think that it's prudent for us to really be cautious about watching any of these moves that puts us closer to that outcome. And it's almost like
so many of them, Kevin, I just want to emphasize, I want to underline something you're saying. So many of these are indeed no bid contracts, no review contracts. So some of the entire structure of the ethics of the awards of these contracts is being, you know, shortcut seriously.
And do you think he's setting up? That's really well said, Kevin. The danger of that. I mean, I kind of get carried away emotionally there, but you know, what occurred to me is, wow. So just by floating that idea out there of, oh, we're going to cancel this payroll tax, he's sort of hoping maybe to set the stage for some move towards privatization if he were to get reelected.
I think that's what he does at every opportunity.
Dollars at stake there.
Along with lives that depend on Social Security.
And the whole post office situation. Go ahead, Kevin, I'm sorry.
The way this works in our country these days is the income disparities, where those who are leading large corporations or businesses or industries, you know, earn, you know, tens of millions, maybe hundreds of millions of dollars a year. And what all that means is that, yes, you get the service, but guess who, you guess how much you're going to pay for it, because you got to sustain the oligarch, the billionaire who owns all of that stuff now that it's privatized. Infrastructure Week to Trump means toll roads that his rich buddies can invest and then collect the toll road taxes. So it's all a pattern. It is something to be aware of. And of course, they'll say that, oh, you're just a socialist. And I'm saying, no, I think that I want to have, more small ownership, more opportunities for more people, take those huge businesses like has been done in the past, and make sure that we do have appropriate reduction in the size of some of those huge businesses, creates more economic opportunity, less ability for multi-billionaires to prosper. Sorry, guys, you probably have enough money anyway, but it really gives more opportunity across the base of the country.
So, it's a great description, Kevin, of the difference, you know, of the attractions of a regulated capitalist system.
Yeah, but be careful. Think about this. The airline industry was highly regulated. And was it Reagan, I believe, that came in and deregulated the airline? And when he did, it started a whole bunch of startups of little companies that came in that thought they could do it better because it wasn't regulated. And it worked. The fares dropped. It didn't affect safety in some instances. It did, but mostly it did not. But mostly it didn't. But the point is, that was from deregulation, not more regulation. So that's something to think about.
I think your point is well taken, Truman, about these, you know, we shouldn't get utopian and so idealistic that we don't think these are hard choices with many, many layers of meaning and consequence and nuance and, you know, points of view along them. They're not easy sometimes when we get together. It's so fun to be of like minds and persuasion and be creative in our own way. We forget that business thrives in that same, quote, academia setting of, you know, free market ideas. That's true. I can't deny that.
Michael?
And I agree with that, Truman. I think what we want to work toward, what a competent government that is concerned for the common weal works toward, is appropriate regulation. And of course, people go too far at time to time, and that's called being human. And so it has to be reined in. But we've gone so far now. I was doing some research last night, and I saw that this floored me, the 10 wealthiest billionaires on the planet, 10 have more wealth than the bottom 3.8 billion human beings on the planet. Mm-hmm. That's how out of control this is. Mm-hmm.
We have our own oligarchs, and, you know, Kevin,
I don't even know if oligarch does the...
Well, that's what it is. What is it? 8 families, 400 families own most of the wealth in America.
10 individual wealthiest multi-billionaires. Susan, what?
Well, yeah, and those are not oligarchs, like, attached to a nation. They are global warlords. I think of them as warlords, and... Of course, their billions come from exploiting the, what did you say, 3.8 billion
people, the poorest on earth.
Right. So if we stand up to them, we 3.8 billions, then they're going to have to modify the way they collect their wealth. How much does it take, really? How much money do you need, folks? Truman.
Yeah, but who's going to decide how much do you need? I mean, look, come on. It's got to be market driven. And those billionaires provide income and they stimulate the economy of the whole world, for crying out loud. That 300 billion, there's jobs provided to those people. Now, I mean, I agree, you know, it's out of whack, but they are providing employment to a whole bunches of people. They drive the economy.
Is it not a balancing act? And is corruption not the idea that self-interest and self-interest and public interest should both be achievable without one strangling the other? And to achieve that balance is not an easy thing, to find the sweet spot of all of that. So I really think, you know, we've done an interesting job in America trying to provide individual rights among the common democracy experiment. And sometimes we hit it out of the ballpark, man, and sometimes we don't. And we're kind of halfway private and halfway public in our orientation. So it's interesting.
Those oligarchs who are running the world run their organizations on the bottom line, which means that they pay those folks who are making their organizations work as little as possible.
That's so right.
That they don't have living wages. That's the immoral and the imbalanced part of it all, is that those big guys need to be sharing more
there with you go.
the rest of us so that there is some balance in lifestyles and in income and in support of families rather than destroying families because they can't make enough money to eat or because they have to work three jobs and leave their children behind, blah, blah, blah. Okay, Truman, I've had my...
Agree, Truman.
No, all I was going to say is, you know, one way to work around that is to have the I'm just going blank on the term. Anyways, where you share the if you reach certain goals, you share the profit sharing. There we go. It took a while for it to grab there, but you know, the company I used to work for, we had some goals, and if we hit these certain goals, then we had profit sharing. It was based on, you know, the percentage of what you made and blah blah blah. But boy, I tell you what, it could make a big difference in the amount of money that you made over time. Yeah, go ahead, Kevin.
I think it's interesting, True, that, you know, we talk about the the business owners who do create opportunities for employment. But I go back also to the example of deregulating the airline industry, where sometimes those large corporate owners can also block access to others entering the market, keeping the bar high, you know, the cost of entry high, which can actually reduce competition and can reduce innovation in some sense. So I do think it's, what I'm hearing is that we should conclude it's a balancing act, and it's a hard balance to strike. But clearly, if we look at the measure of economic inequity, it's hard to imagine anybody says, yeah, we need more of that.
So
they're talking for themselves. Don't you think there's a point at which when you're talking about self-interest that you don't see that you're one of those guys now, that somebody else thinks it's not for the common good? You know, I think it's very hard to identify who is it guilty and innocent? Is it just, you know, there's a slope, you know, and you meet somewhere. If you're not at the top, at least you're not drowning, you know. So, I don't know how we classify all of this.
So we have about 3 minutes left. I just want to throw out one other quick thing in talking about regulation and deregulation. I know that that the banks, the banks were way, way out of control, and that caused the whole economic, you know, collapse over the, you know, the real estate and all of that. But once all of those regulations were put into place to try and control that, there was that unintended consequence. I know of people who really needed to have a loan to refinance their home or to buy a home, couldn't get it because they couldn't qualify. Because
did happen initially. Is that still happening?
I've heard it in the last year. Yeah. So, I know that there's some of that regulation has been eased a bit. But boy, when they first came in and slammed it on, it stifled a lot of progress, and it wasn't a good thing. We had to put some fences up for the bigger companies, but it affected some of the small people too. Kevin.
It's intriguing that there was a friend of mine who actually ran a micro bank during the economic before and then after the economic downturn, and they were in the business of making small loans to people who had a hard time qualifying for a loan. And the notion that, you know, the centralizing of all of those loans in one entity, when they all go bad and then the huge entity comes down, is one model that we saw. The other model is very distributed banking systems where those loans are maybe challenging to manage, but they're distributed over multiple entities. So when any one entity suffers and can't keep going, it doesn't bring down the others.
Exactly.
So, you know,
Kevin, you are a policy wonk. Hey, I'm going to grab this last minute, and I'm going to say one quick thing is that my favorite bit of news this week was the eagle versus the drone. Some guy's operating a drone, and the drone flies into a forest, and all of a sudden the video gets haywire and the sound gets haywire on the video feed to the guy operating the drone. And then all of a sudden the thing goes, flies out of the forest and the drone is not to be seen again. my favorite thing of the week. There you go. Metaphor though it may be, ponder that koan.
That's right. For the week. Okay, have guys. A good week, you see guys. Y'all next week.
Thank you for listening to our listener.